This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and our topic today is renewable natural gas a real thing, or is it just industry PR? Shalom Flank from Microgrid Architect will start us out, and then Myra Moss at Ohio State University Extension Office invited Denny Hall to discuss what they're doing over in Ohio related to bioproducts, anaerobic digesters, and such. So, Shalom, why don't you go ahead and start the conversation here.
Sure. Thanks, Sierra. So as Sierra said, I am a microgrid architect, so that means I need to design site-specific projects that have their own generation resources. I get tossed into situations where we need to decide, are we going to go down the electrification pathway? Do we rely on whatever's coming out of the natural gas pipeline in order to generate especially resilient power? If you've got critical loads, and that's the reason you're doing microgrid, then having access to natural gas that enables you to generate electricity on site as well as meet thermal loads is very attractive. But from a climate change perspective, if we're trying to get to 100% carbon neutral, what's the role for the natural gas system? Obviously, we see this in the larger policy context as well. I'm based in Washington, D.C. We have our own public service commission for the District of Columbia, which is kind of a unique situation in the U.S. to have a city have its own PSC. And from a policy perspective, we're wrestling with that same issue for the District of Columbia as a whole. Do we want to go down 100% electrification path? If so, what does that mean for the ever fewer users on the natural gas system? Are they going to wind up having to cover fixed costs with a smaller customer base, classic death spiral? Or as the local gas utility is starting to put forward, are there pathways where instead of using fossil gas, you're using low-carbon or carbon-neutral resources, the chemicals that are in the pipeline, which is now mostly methane, is that going to be biomethane? Is there going to be hydrogen in there, too? How much hydrogen? Where does it come from? The local utility, which is Washington Gas, recently acquired by the Canadian firm AltaGas, hired ICF to do some studies on the potential for biogas, renewable natural gas, and also to compare those pathways of 100% electrification versus some electrification and some decarbonization of the gas grid. And these are all interesting debates, and I don't know what to believe. And I put that question to Sierra, and she said, well, let's put a panel together and combine our, you know, collective expertise and see if there are some interesting conclusions.
All right. So, Denny, do you want to fill us in on some of the things that are happening in Ohio? Maybe you can answer some of these questions, and we'll get other people involved as well.
Okay. All right. Well, with you and share a little bit about some of our bio-based material and biogas. Just as an introduction, I'm the director of the Ohio Bioproducts Innovation Center at Ohio State University. I retired in December of 2018. But the center ran from 2005 until then. And one of our biggest projects was the creation or the support of several anaerobic digesters that were piloted and then successfully operated in Ohio. We had both liquid and we implemented with solid state, looking at solids. Most work with company of Quake Energy, one of many companies out there that do install water treatment or do install inter- investors. and also on both farms and municipalities. And so I think I want to kind of lift up the idea of wastewater treatment plant digesters as kind of being a really interesting place to go as a society. There's so much we talk about recycling and we're talking about clearly the energy value that can be harvested from these biosolids or this biomass, but there's so much more than just energy. You know, there's also plant nutrients and carbon that can be used to improve our soils. And so I'm really a big fan of anaerobic digesters that are connected to municipalities. And, you know, one of the big advantages of that is that all of the suppliers for your biomass are connected by way of a pipe, and they flush the toilet or wash the solids down a drain, and it runs downhill for the most part to a place where it can be collected and then processed. And you know, that's so much better than having to pick it up with a truck or do anything else. And then you've got, the ability to produce energy, but also, the ability to harvest the biosolids and convert those into useful materials and send them back to the land. So when we think of a circular economy, I think wastewater treatment plant digesters are a really important piece of that strategy. So maybe I'll throw that out as an introduction and see what other kinds of questions you have.
Benny, this is Shalom again. Thank you for that. I completely agree that for the biosolids from wastewater treatment facilities, that anaerobic digestion is pretty much a no-brainer. I've been at a number of those facilities, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. But in terms of the impact on the gas grid and the electric grid, every installation that I've seen has produced less electricity than the wastewater treatment facility itself needs in order to operate. So there's no opportunity there, as far as I can tell, to export into the gas grid and make that available as a replacement for fossil natural gas to other users. So I guess the question is, can we scale some of these low-carbon or zero-carbon sources to the point where it really does enable a low-carbon gas grid as an alternative to 100% electrification?
Well, I want to counter that with another idea. If all you're doing is processing the waste streams from in a municipal wastewater treatment facility, if there's any way that you can harvest or collect food waste from like restaurants and food service institutions, food processing plants, et cetera. The problem with only wastewater as a feedstock is that it's already been digested one time. And there's not near as much energy in there as there was one time previously. And so if there's any way to capture and process, insert food waste, into the digester, all of a sudden your yields of biogas will greatly expand. So most wastewater treatment plants don't operate with a model where they receive tipping fees for receiving food waste as well. But, greases and fast food waste, all of those kinds of things could really greatly increase the yield to the point where you're able to produce much more power than what you need to operate the facility.
Right, and I'm really appreciating this back and forth, and I'll augment that with the example of Harvest Power down in Orlando, Florida. where they are following that strategy. They collect all the food waste from Disney World, as well as the fat, oil, and grease, what's called fog, and add that into the anaerobic digesters, and they're able to produce enough excess biogas that they combust that on site in a set of reciprocating engines and generate about 6 megawatts of power that get added in to the local distribution grid in Orlando. So that is definitely a case where they're able to achieve enough scale to export back out onto the grid. In this case, they're exporting back out onto the electric grid. They could have done the gas cleanup and injected it into the gas pipeline, but for whatever reasons, I think they went the other pathway. I think that's a terrific example.
Yeah, I've actually been to that digester, so I've seen that operate. And that's a classic example of being able to combine waste streams to generate more power. And then you also have the nutrients that you can use for the in the case of Disneyland, the landscapes and the farms that surround it.
Anybody want to weigh in on this?
This is Jerry Braun. I can add a couple things from California experience and also some work I've done recently on the subject of decarbonizing the gas fuel sector locally. The U.S. is not in the lead on some of the things that, by the way, very good introduction, very helpful from both sides, Shalom and Denny. But U.S. is, I guess, partly because natural gas is very inexpensive here. But pervasive, it may be the reason why so much more is happening in other countries. For example, in Germany, there are more than 10,000 biogas plants as of a couple of years ago. China has more than 6,000, whereas the U.S. has a little over 2,000. And so our experience is limited. I guess I would say that the industry is not as well as robust as it would need to be to be able to do things at scale and in a more comprehensive way as was suggested. In California, a couple of things that I think are worth noting. Yes, exactly what Denny said. There is a problem with wastewater treatment plants. A couple of them, and we have one here where I live. Part of the issue is the quality of the waste stream. If it's not if there are not a lot of solids and biomaterials in it, if it's weak, it's hard to make the digester process pencil out. That's one thing. So the other thing is that wastewater is probably the third most important source of biosolids, and certainly landfill gas has been is a big source of biogas, which can be converted into biomethane, and likewise, so agricultural waste, dairy farms, pig farms, and so forth. And one thing that I would like to put on, remind us that the decarbonization or climate mitigation impacts are sometimes forgotten, and it's a kind of an obscure it's not superficially obvious what the climate implications are, but especially with landfill and agricultural waste, farm waste. What happens if you don't convert the waste to biogas or biomethane is that anaerobic digestion occurs in the landfill or in the collection of waste on the farm, and that produces methane, which is 20 times more potent greenhouse gas than just burning or somehow converting the organic material to biogas. And that is something that I would hope would begin to be an economic weight on the scales in favor of doing more of this conversion. And I would just close with the comment that those 10,000 biogas plants in Germany have had the effect of a decarbonization effect of close to 2% reduction in overall greenhouse emissions there. So this is not insignificant. And, that might sound like not much, but compared to everything else that you can do locally, it's a really big deal. And so I just wanted to close with that thought.
This is Lou Nguyen.
Go ahead, Lou.
Yeah, I'm just looking at your initial questions about it being a real thing and is there value. I agree with everything that the gentleman has talked about, on this call. I think the one thing though that makes renewable natural gas maybe less feasible for power production is the economics around this, because this is I'd be curious to what others are thinking about this, but with the low carbon fuel standards that are driven primarily by the Western markets, California as an example, it's placing a huge value on renewable natural gas. And so that's what's going to make it, I think, less feasible for power generation in the context of microgrids. But there is extreme value for renewable natural gas, and I think that value is going out west. Into the LCFS markets, where the value of carbon credits there is up, I think it's $200 per metric ton there. So the value of it is driving the scarcity of that, which is also driving the economics of that for power production as well. But it's out there. There's just not a lot of it, and it is being demanded by other markets.
Any thoughts?
I'm sorry, this is Jerry. Yes, that's true. That's a valid comment for California, speaking from being here. There, most of the renewable natural gas now is being used for heavy duty transportation fueling. A lot of the, for example, the waste hauling fleets are, I think, something like 70%, you know, natural gas, but 70%, you know, and a very large share of that is renewable natural gas. So, mm-hmm. yeah, transportation, you know, is a high value market for renewable natural gas, but there's also a lot of potential, untapped potential to produce renewable natural gas. And in California, we do have some projects where the local jurisdiction and the gas utility are working together to get, you know, to get the renewable gas into the pipeline. And in fact, Southern California Gas has a proposal before the PUC now to offer renewable gas as a, you know, almost like, you know, renewable electricity is sold at a premium in the electricity market out here. So will renewable gas be, and it will likely be. It certainly does make sense to, you know, to think of it for power generation, especially in the microgrid context, because, you know, a fully resilient microgrid really needs some source of long-term energy storage, which fuel has always provided. And so it's a natural connection with the microgrids and making them resilient.
Bob, it looks like you were trying to say something. And one thing, too, please, everybody, mute your own phones because there is some background noise. Not a lot, but no, let's eliminate some of that. Bob Perry, did you want to say something?
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, is renewable natural gas a thing, a real thing? Absolutely, at least in the short term. I mean, out here in California, you know, natural gas is written into our infrastructure DNA. I mean, it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort and time to transition out of this legacy infrastructure. So to the extent possible, we need to think of any and every way we can to take waste and plant byproducts and convert it into something so that we can start weaning ourselves off of extracted natural gas. And so I totally agree with Denny. I think that, you know, you have to, communities have to not look at the landfill and the water, wastewater treatment plant as separate items. These are two elements that need to work together to maximize production and efficiency. And, you know, my focus is on energy resilience or community resiliency, and a wastewater treatment plant is about as critical a facility as you can have, a community can have. So every wastewater treatment plant should be as self-sufficient as possible. One other thing in California, and to a lesser extent Colorado, is that, you know, we have, or did have prior to these wildfires, about 140 million dead trees due to climate change. And it's represents just a massive amount of fuel that sits there as a potential carbon event. I think the fires of the last few years, you know, who knows? I haven't seen any estimates on the amount of carbon released from those fires. But here's an instance where, you know, if you can take dead timber and produce syngas through gasification and you know, first of all, convert it to a syngas that could be used in reciprocating engines or from fossil fueled infrastructure, but eventually produce hydrogen from that. You know, that's another huge opportunity to not only prevent potentially a massive carbon event, but to convert that into something that's useful. So, yeah, I think it's definitely a real thing. Is it something that we want to be a way of life 20, 30 years out? No, I'd like to, you know, hope that in 20 to 30 years, whatever renewable natural gas is used is being applied to only those industries that are the hardest to operate using renewable energy and keep that to a minimum. But I think, you know, for the next 10 to 20 years, we need to really be creative to reduce, you know, what the methane use that's just going to happen just because we have this massive legacy infrastructure.
Hey, I have a question for Denny. Denny, do you know of any technologies that are available right now that have the emission level that can be approved in states for biomass as far as wood is concerned?
You mean for combustion? Like if you were to burn the I mean, because as was suggested,
well, pyrolysis would be one way of doing it. But there's been some technologies out there that are biomass technologies. I think Vermont has some of those, but I'm not sure those technologies have the emissions standards or the emissions to be approved by, for instance, California and other states. So I'm just curious to know if there's any technologies out there that can do that.
Well, it's not a field that I'm knowledgeable of. I can't answer that for you.
Well, Bob or Denny, if we're talking about things like wood waste or the feedstocks that don't have that very high moisture content that you would use with anaerobic digestion, then Bob, you mentioned I guess it was thermal gasification. For those 140 million dead trees. Is that an approach that is being applied at scale? Is there a cost curve that would say, you know, hey, in 10 years we could be producing syngas or hydrogen or biomethane or whatever form it is at a cost that's vaguely competitive to natural gas today?
Well, I've been working with the Southern Sierra Conservation District. They're out in a town called Aubrey, which is at the base of the Sierras, just due east of Fresno. They've converted an abandoned lumber mill, and they're beginning. They have a very small, you know, kind of proof of concept. A gasification unit that they're running through, you know, they're chipping up the lumber and they're running it through that, and they're also taking the bigger pieces and turning it into biochar, and up there it's like you can't turn around without running into stacks of dead timber. It's just everywhere. Now, recently they had fires up there, so I'm not sure what the present state of that is, but you know, all up and down the Sierras, there are these small towns. They're economically disadvantaged. They all have abandoned lumber mills because the lumber industry has left. And you know, it's a model that at a minimum can be used to create local power for microgrids. They're estimating that, you know, that the amount of energy they could produce could power the entire community just on that. And, you know, if you can bring it up to scale responsibly, now you get into issues of reforestation and how do you do it responsibly. That there's a lot of devil in the details with that. But these projects are happening, and there's about two or three in California and a couple in Oregon that are kind of in the pilot project basis. But there are a lot of synergies here. There's an economic recovery. There's the syngas production. There's the energy resilience and not having to run transmission lines into the mountains, you know, where all the wildfires. There's a lot of different co-benefits that can be realized from that type of a project.
Yeah, I might mention, this is Denny, I might mention that I'm also aware that the state of Maine has had a big initiative in recent years to repurpose their paper mills that were no longer being used, and they're coming up with new materials for that. And I understand that a renewable diesel is going to be coming out of their wood streams as well. So your point about the trees that have been killed and are laying waste, there's a lot of people that see those as feedstocks in the bio-based industries, and then the paper mill infrastructure that, you know, we're not using near as much paper as we used to, that repurposing those to produce bio-based fuels and energy for us is another great opportunity.
That's beautiful. I hadn't heard that. I'm really happy to hear that, you know, that people are taking that approach back east. That's great.
So what kind of technologies are out there right now that are able to do that? Because I know the California emission standards were high enough that they had a hard time getting those through right in California, any kind of a biomass type of technology. Anybody know?
Yeah, I mean,
Sarah, this is Jerry. I think, don't forget about fuel cells. I think we're kind of on the cusp of a fuel cell surge, especially with fuel cell vehicles. But there are stationary power technologies that are fairly mature. They've been around for in development and now are pretty well commercial. For megawatt scale power production, and they are based on what is called an internal reformer, which basically takes natural gas into the fuel cell stack and changes it into hydrogen and carbon monoxide, and then the fuel cell operates on that. So, and that is a very low emissions. That certainly meets California's standards and anybody else's. So there are ways of doing conversion of natural gas and bio and renewable natural gas, to produce electricity. Whether it's economical and cost competitive right now, I can't speak to that, especially. Given that renewable natural gas will come at a price premium, but it's certainly feasible.
What about municipal solid waste? Anything happening in that direction?
So, Sierra, this is Jeff Hinsky, and I got two related to the technologies I was going to bring up. And the California Energy Commission over the last few days has had a virtual conference going on, or symposium that they call EPIC, which is, energy something. Anyway, talking about the future of energy in California and things like that. And part of this symposium was some mini pitch sessions by startup companies. And there were two of them that I found quite interesting, related specifically to this type of technology, if you will. And one is a company called Electroactive Technologies, and they basically have a microbial-based technology, a biofilm they talk, and I'm no technical expert in these areas, so I can't tell you whether this stuff is truly revolutionary or not, but that basically takes food waste or a food waste stream and directly produces hydrogen and electricity. And then obviously that hydrogen can be used as either into fuel cells and or as a direct feedstock into generation. And then the second company was a company called AquaCycle, and they are using what they call a bioelectrical treatment technology, but again a biological method for wastewater stream treatment that they claim, also produces electricity directly, and produces hydrogen, again, no methane. And so it's a different type of, it's not a straight kind of anaerobic thing. Both these companies are claiming that, as they mature, they will have lower costs than anything that's available, et cetera, et cetera. But again, I can't vouch for the capabilities, but both of them are also in prototype or demonstration project phases with a couple of different areas. So, maybe down the road in the not too distant future, there'll be some revolutionary technologies that kind of make option, if you will, renewable natural gas, sort of a moot point.
Okay, interesting. Anybody else?
Sarah, this is Shalom again.
Go ahead.
This is actually making me more optimistic that at least for the kind of point solutions, critical infrastructure, microgrids, for example, or remote communities, including the economic development aspect, RNG or biogas more generally sounds like it could be a real thing, and there's some promising technologies. I would point out, by the way, I'm told that the existing natural gas distribution infrastructure, pipelines, et cetera, could accommodate today 10 to 20% hydrogen content with extremely minimal changes, if anything. And I've also heard maybe up to 50% with some modest upgrades. So if some of these processes are producing hydrogen, we may already have the infrastructure in place to be able to get that from where it's produced to where it's needed. But I'm still left with the question beyond the point applications, but more at the grid scale. Because when I look at the electrification pathway, and I think about especially in heating dominant areas, so not California so much, but the Northeast, Upper Midwest, et cetera, even with high efficiency heat pumps, and the heat pumps are getting better at the lower temperatures, air source heat pumps, but still, as the temperatures get colder, the electricity demand of the heat pumps goes up, and instead of having peak demand on the electricity grid in the summertime from cooling, we would have, I think, from the analysis I've seen, we'd have significantly higher peaks in the wintertime instead. And we don't have the transmission or distribution capacity to meet that peak demand if we switch from natural gas-based heating to electrified heating. So that seems like a big cost in addition to what do you do with all the intermittency, you need all the storage, you need additional transmission lines and so forth. So there starts to be this big, big backlog for investment beyond just making the renewable electricity if you try to go down that 100% electrification path, which is a wonderful path and it's inspiring, but it also worries me that we're not really accounting for those costs. Is there the potential for enough scale of biogas and RNG done responsibly so that we don't have to go all the way down that path and can avoid some of those peak associated stressors on the system that could cost us, you know, potentially $1 trillion?
No, this is Jerry. The short answer is that, number one, you're right, that the if we were to electrify all heating in some states, it would triple the peak electricity demand. So this is obviously something that needs to be an evolutionary change. But at the same time, I see the renewable gas as, you know, potentially being able to supply close to the, you know, not, you know, a significant portion of current heating demand in at least in California, and it is a pathway. Doing that is a pathway to renewable hydrogen, which is not yet quite competitive. But as you say, you know, there's quite a debate going on in the gas industry in terms of how much and where renewable hydrogen could be distributed. It really depends on the specific local infrastructure, but the percentages are, you know, potentially in the 5 to 20% range, And that's more than enough for right now. And of course, the infrastructure will be being upgraded, in parallel. So these are important scenarios for the longer term. But doing something now is the right way to, you know, to move the ball forward toward those longer term solutions.
This is James Ornstein in the Dallas area in Texas. And there's a concern here, and we don't have the heating loads that you're talking about, but, various cities are moving towards climate action plans that require decarbonization by, some percentage by 2035 and some by 2050. And there's a concern from some people that they need to go immediately to requiring full electrification. So they don't want to put in new natural gas infrastructure and new housing development. They don't want to put money into upgrading and maintaining the existing natural gas infrastructure. And the reason being that you could go to renewable natural gas as an interim step, but it's still not net zero carbon. So the only way to get to net zero carbon is by doing some kind of synthetic fuels that may or may not ever be economical.
This is David Upero, and I really appreciate this discussion. It's opening my eyes because maybe like some of you, I think of everything sort of from the perspective of electric energy, electricity, electric power, and electrification is always being such a good thing, and forbidding new development that even have gas infrastructure always seems sort of like intuitively a good thing. But when we think about how much carbon content there is in solid waste and wastewater, not to mention agricultural and food, the agricultural waste, there's a lot of carbon there. And if that is converted to renewable natural gas, it seems that especially in places like the North where they need huge amounts of energy to heat, that seems like a kind of a no-brainer that would make more sense than trying to electrify everything, especially right away. So I really like this discussion. And I also... I would imagine that the amount of solid waste and wastewater and agricultural waste that is being converted to energy now is a very small percentage, and so there's tremendous potential, I would imagine. And then in the concept of keeping it local seems to one of the speakers was talking about coordinating the effort to deal with wastewater and solid waste, which makes eminent sense. And keeping that at the local level, it just seems that sustainable communities can develop these initiatives in tandem to greatly increase the amount of waste that is going into energy and to minimize the need to build new transmission lines. Or even natural gas lines, because if you keep it local, each community can basically sustain itself, even in the North, with producing renewable natural gas for heating and also for electricity.
This is Dick Paul again, and I just want to come back to your original question. Is renewable natural gas a real thing or just industry PR? And I will throw out this one basic point, is that natural gas, at least here in Ohio, is so darn cheap. That's probably one of the last things we really want to do with biomass, is try to produce something to substitute for natural gas. And so, for example, I know several of your participants are in California, and up near Oakland, we have a business called Mango Materials which is taking natural gas or biogas and converting that into a biodegradable plastic. And so we're really looking for much more valuable things to do with biomass than the lowest, you know, cheapest thing that's out there, and that right now is natural gas. So I just want to throw that in the equation here. Now, if there is comes a day when we really start to value carbon like you do in California, you know, for its external cost, then maybe all of a sudden a lot of these things that we think have value, you know, for all of the sustainability reasons, might actually also have value economically. So I just wanted, before we adjourn the call, wanted to make sure and underscore the point that renewable natural gas isn't something that we're largely targeting. We do produce it because we have the materials and the capabilities to do it, but I'm always looking for ways to convert that natural gas into something more valuable.
This is Bob Peary again. I think one thing that needs to be kept in mind is that, you know, we talk about transitioning to a zero carbon society. You know, we also need to transition to a zero waste society. So I think the overall, one of the main points, you know, in my mind is zero waste, achieving zero waste is an end unto itself. It has a value. And what you do with that waste, you know, it's all good. You know, if you can find a more profitable use that you know doesn't result in emissions, carbon emissions, that's awesome. So I just want to point that, you know, this zero waste needs to be a really big part of our overall transition as a society. One quick comment on Texas: the solar and wind potential of Texas is so huge that it could become the renewable hydrogen capital of the world. You know, I just want to throw that out there. I mean, you could have entire cities running on hydrogen out there because of the amount of energy that you can generate. And one last point is, you know, the scenario in the cold states. I'm from California, so I don't really know what cold is, but I think one workaround would be to utilize low-level geothermal systems, residential geothermal systems, that, you know, able to use the ground, the temperature stability of you know, just 100 feet down to keep interior temperatures relatively stable, and that would greatly reduce your heating needs, whether it's gas or electricity. So,
all right. Dick White, did you want to say something? I think it looked like you're unmuting your phone.
My phone doesn't want.
Yeah, there you go. Go ahead and talk. Huh. Interesting. Your phone keeps coming and going. I don't have you muted, so it's on your end. Okay, go ahead. Oh, that's strange. His phone keeps shutting off. Maybe you could get to a different phone. It's not staying open. Okay. Well, go ahead and keep trying, because I don't know what's going on there. It's really strange. It shows that it's coming and going, so I don't know why. But anybody else right now until Dick gets his phone straightened out? So I have a question for you, Danny. Is anaerobic digestion digesters cost-effective for farmers?
Well, it depends on the operation, I guess, and because what's your normal manure management strategy? And so if the most cost-effective way of dealing with manure is just to land apply it. But if you're in a, you know, a heavily populated area and you know, people don't want to have to deal with your manure management strategy, then it's a matter of controlling odors. And so that's when anaerobic digestion can make sense. But again, like I said before, if it's just the manure that you're digesting, then probably not. But if you have a way of being able to receive a tipping fee for some other high energy food waste, then yeah, that can be valuable. But for the most part, it's probably too technical, too heavy capital costs to really be a economic benefit to the farm. But if it enables you to have more cows or enables you to have more pigs, then maybe it makes sense.
All right, thank you. Anybody else?
Danny, what about some of the other agricultural waste? This is Shalom again. You know, the corn stover, the stalk and plant drier waste than manure. What do you think is the opportunity there?
Well, you know, we've had several cellulosic ethanol plants came online in Iowa and I think Nebraska, and they've both been shut down because they weren't able to compete. But you know, ultimately to take the sugars that are in those waste streams and or those that biomass and convert it into an ethanol or something like that would be a useful material. Some people are taking those I shouldn't say some people. In a lab, we can make aviation fuels out of them. There are lots of ways of converting them, but right now the economics are not supporting those models to commercialize.
Right. Now, though, that's for liquid fuel applications, which are obviously, you know, the most valuable. And I appreciate, I forget whose point it was, maybe Bob, that natural gas is the cheapest. So that's kind of the last ranked thing that you want to be targeting. But nonetheless, for the cellulosic materials, if you're trying to produce a thin gas instead of trying to produce a liquid fuel, does that change the economics?
Well, no one's doing it, so I'd say at this point, no. But does it have potential? Yes.
Dick, were you trying to talk again?
Yeah, I think it's a very simple issue. Anyway, the question I had is about composting. As you know, traditionally, the agricultural waste went back to nurturing the land, and nurturing soil is a big deal. So one of the questions is about the ability to use the, particularly what's mentioned as direct food waste from restaurants, into commercial composting facilities, and then having that as a viable fertilizer for particularly local agriculture. There's an effort to make that happen here in Southwest Colorado. Where we don't have a high population density, but we do have some ag, and people are trying to make that waste stream work.
I'll just say that, so that's aerobic digestion versus anaerobic digestion, composting is. That's valuable if you have smaller density population, but by aeration, you're off-gassing the carbon dioxide as the biomass decomposes. It's breathing, so you're sending off carbon dioxide and in some cases ammonia. If you use anaerobic digestion, you're actually capturing that carbon and converting it to energy. So there is, in some situations, composting makes a lot of sense, but But in other situations where, like on a utility scale, on a larger scale, it might be more valuable to anaerobic digest it and produce methane.
All right, we're just about out of time here. Anybody else?
Sarah, I just want to thank you for taking basically an offhand comment on another call and assembling a great group for a really important discussion, I think. It's been helpful for me, at least. So thank you.
Thank you for your offhand comment. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So, any other comments here? All right. Well, we can go ahead and end it now. We have an interesting conference or webinar tomorrow, which I think I mentioned before with Lynn Arthur talking about convincing people to move forward on renewable energy, and she's created a process that would be very valuable for any city. So if you have any cities or towns you're trying to work with, I would suggest inviting them to the webinar. And thanks very much, Denny Hall and Myra Moss. Myra, for inviting Denny, and Denny for being a guest presenter today. Very interesting and very informative information. And, of course, Alan, thanks for your idea and your contribution and everybody else. So I hope to see you all tomorrow. And if not, I'll be sending out information about the November calls probably in a week or so. And I hope everybody's staying safe. This is important right now. So thanks again.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks. Great presentation and conversation. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.